format for these evening talks that I usually follow. I'll start by giving some instructions on metta meditation, and then we'll do a guided meditation, and following that we'll have any questions. So the very beautiful words of the Metta Sutta we've just recited, and Metta Sutta has basically three sections. The first third of the Metta Sutta is talking about essentially how to be a good person, how to be a person who's who's living a life in a way to become like a receptacle or a vessel for loving kindness. The second, the middle part of it is talking essentially about the method of developing metta, and the last third is talking about what the state of that is, what it's like. So this is something which is important to remember, that metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, like all kinds of meditation, is not something which is separate from the rest of life. Okay, it's not something that we can just come along and do and think we can fix our problems with it. And this is something that is sometimes criticized these days, that people like to do teach various kinds of therapies and so on, and they'll come along and they'll take bits and pieces of Buddhist ideas like mindfulness or metta or something, and then use it out of context. And of course, you can do that and it will work to a certain degree, but soon enough, if you're just taking bits and pieces of the path, soon enough you'll come up against the limits. It'll help to a certain degree, but doesn't have the really powerful transformative potential that the path as a whole does when we practice it. So I want you to remember this while we're on the retreat, that this retreat period in a way offers a very special set of conditions. Many things have come together to enable that to happen. And those conditions will only last, like all conditions, they'll only last for a very short time. Soon enough, we'll be thrown back out there in the cruel world. And that's where we'll really learn. What lessons do we take home? What have we really accomplished on this retreat? So one of the things that meditation offers us, and which a retreat offers us, is a structure. It gives us a set of boundaries. And the boundaries are useful. They give us, having those boundaries gives us the scope within those boundaries that we can feel things, we can do things, we can experience things that we wouldn't necessarily be comfortable with feeling outside of those boundaries. Just to give you a classic example of that, because my background is a musician. And one of the things about, if you've ever played music or composed music, is you know that music is actually very mathematical. Yeah, everything's fours and eights and 16s, everything fits together. And songs are put together out of actually a very constrained set of kind of mathematics. You know, you have a 12-bar format or a 32-bar format, and the way the repetitions are handled and so on. If you know how to analyze it, it's actually very tight, it's very constrained. But when you listen to music, you don't hear those constraints. Actually, music is then very emotional. Yeah, isn't it? Music is actually very emotional. But it's very emotional because of those constraints. And so that's why when someone's singing a song, they can say things in public that they would never say otherwise. Yeah, you go to a karaoke bar, and I've been to a karaoke bar, like ever, okay, even before I was a monk, I never went to a karaoke bar, just to clarify that. But I imagine that if you went to a karaoke bar, if one was to go, people sing all kinds of things, yeah? Oh, I love you, baby, I'll never last a night without you, or whatever. You'd never say in ordinary conversation, yeah? And that's because of the boundaries. You know, it's only a 3-minute song. At the end of it, it's finished. Yeah? So it's the same thing in meditation. When you come down to meditate, you have the boundaries. We have the boundaries of the retreat, the boundaries of the precept, the boundaries of that period of time within which you're sitting meditation. And within those boundaries, you can allow yourself to feel all kinds of things that you might not be comfortable with feeling in everyday life. And this is one of the great advantages of meditation. So if we'll feel grief, or we'll feel anger, or we'll feel excitement, we'll feel love, we'll feel joy, all of those things, just let them come through, let them play out. Yeah. They have their boundary. So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to develop, mostly to develop loving kindness. And in the real world, there are lots of barriers to developing loving kindness. There are lots of fears, aren't there? We have a lot of fears that if we love too much, we're going to get hurt. Isn't that right? We're afraid. We put up boundaries between ourselves and others. Yeah, when you meet strangers, we distrust them. Yeah, where we don't share our feelings with them. It takes a long time before we are ready to really connect with somebody. So everything we do, that there are divisions, there are disconnections, and we have to disconnect also from our own feelings, because we can't get through the day if you're just going to indulge in your feelings. You've got a job to do. Shove your feelings to one side and get your job done. Yeah. So we learn to disconnect and to manage our feelings. And that's not wrong in and of itself, right? We have to do it. It's learning to manage our emotions is part of what we have to do to be healthy adults. But it does tend to put a barrier in that deepening of that loving kindness. So this is why when we're doing the meditation and we have that space, we have a safe space here in the retreat center, we have a safe group of people around us, a supportive, loving group of people, we have the support of the community. We know that we're here practicing with that wholesome intention within the scope of the Buddha's teachings. So there's nothing to be afraid of. There's nothing to be defensive about. Yeah? And we can allow ourselves to feel that love, which normally we're too afraid to feel. Normally we hold back. So the point of doing the loving kindness meditation is to get in touch with that feeling of loving kindness, to hold that feeling and to develop it. Yeah? Now the feeling of loving kindness itself is very ordinary. Okay? It's very ordinary. You all have it. Yeah? Basically anybody, if you're not a raving psychopath serial killer, then you've got some loving kindness. And even, I think, probably most raving psychopath serial killers still have some loving kindness in them somewhere. So we all have it. Yeah? But what tends to happen is that these things tend to just move at random through us. Yeah, sometimes we feel love, sometimes compassion, sometimes hate, sometimes jealousy. These things come and go. And most of the time we're hardly even aware of it, much less having any control or any say over what it is that we're feeling. So when we're doing the metta meditation, our goal, the secret to metta meditation, the real secret to it, is being able to notice and identify, to recognize what that feeling of loving kindness is. That's one of the great secrets of metta meditation. So to help us do this, then we use a method. And like any other meditation method, this method has its own advantages and its own disadvantages. Okay? So I'm going to be talking quite a lot about the meditation method over the next few days. But before I do that, I want to tell a little bit of a parable. And I want to suggest to you a somewhat heretical thought, which is, what is the purpose of a meditation method? And my answer to that is that the purpose of a meditation method is to distract you from your meditation. The purpose of a meditation method is to distract you from your meditation. So what do I mean by that? Well, here I'll give you a parable. Man was walking through the forest. He comes across another man. The second man is in a pond of water, up to his knees, wading round in the pond of water, which is very muddy. And the man's wading around, and he keeps on putting his hands on the top of the water and pushing down like that, and jumping from one place in the pond to another, putting his hand on the surface of the water and like pushing it down. And the man who was walking along the path saw this for a little while and thought to himself, what's going on? What's this fellow doing? He's wearing himself out, splashing around in the water like that. So he asked him, good sir, what's going on? What are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm trying to clean the pond water. He said, what? He said, yes, you can see the pond water has all this mud in it. I'm pushing all the mud down to the bottom of the pond so that the water will be nice and clear. The second man says, ah, I see. But he said, the first man says, it seems to be a problem. The more I push it down, the more muddier it gets. He says, yeah, I can see there's a bit of a problem there. He says, I've got another method that will help you push all the mud down to the bottom of the pond water. He says, right, what do we do? He says, well, this is what we need. We need some planks, a hammer and nails, some grass, yeah, and a pot, 9 pot. He says, how is that going to help us push the mud to the bottom of the pool? He says, don't worry about it. Just go and get those things. So the fellow went and get those things. And they busied themselves clearing a bit of ground next to the pond, hammering all the bits of wood together, stitching all the grass together. They lit a fire. By the time they lit the fire, the water in the pond was nice and clean. He said, could you get me a bit of water in this pot? We can make a cup of tea and sit down and watch the nice clean pond. And they made a seat and a little shelter, and they sat down drinking a cup of tea and watching the pond. So this is my parable about what a meditation method is. So that's what the meditation method is. It's telling you how to build a little shelter, a little seat, and how to make a cup of tea. So you can get out of the way. Stop jumping around inside your mind trying to fix everything. Stop trying to push the mud down to the bottom of the pool. The mud will sink down to the bottom of the pool of water all by itself. Yeah? There's only one thing stopping it, and that's you getting in there and messing around with it. So that's why we give a meditation technique. It's so you get out of the way. It gives you something to do. Yeah? And you think, oh, here I am meditating and fixing my mind. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but this is how it really seems to me, is that when you're meditating and you sit and you meditate, and then all of a sudden you turn around and somehow your mind's become still without you even noticing it. Has anybody else ever felt like that? Yeah? You see, where did that come from? Suddenly it's just there. Yeah? So don't mistake the meditation method for the thing itself. Okay? This meditation method is just a set of guidelines and principles that can be helpful. Get us out of the way. Let the mind become peaceful by itself. Okay, so this is a particular method. I'll give you some of the details and I'll give you an overview of this method for this evening. And I'll give more details on the different stages of it over the next few nights. So as I mentioned last night, this method is taught by a monk called Ajahn Maha Chapchai. And essentially, the essence of the method is this, that one develops loving kindness in turn for each of four people, for oneself, a loved person, a neutral person, and a disliked person. The disliked person in certain circles is known as the husband. But never mind about that. We'll be coming on to the disliked person a little bit later on. Okay, so that oneself, a loved one, a neutral person, and a disliked person. The idea here is that we're covering that whole kind of emotional spectrum, yeah, of attraction, neutral, and then repulsion. Yeah, and by developing loving kindness equally and evenly for each of those persons, we reach a stage where we can't tell the difference anymore, where there is no loved person, no neutral person, no disliked person. Yeah? Any difference between them is just gone. It's what, in Pali, they use the word sima sambheda, is the breaking down of the barriers. So this is what we're going to try to move towards during this retreat. But like all Buddhist meditations, all real, authentic Buddhist meditations, they start with something very ordinary. I don't know if you've noticed that when you look at the different kinds of Buddhist meditations, they all start with something very ordinary and end up somewhere very extraordinary. Yeah? You start by watching your breath, the most ordinary thing in the world, and it ends up becoming quite extraordinary. So the same thing with loving kindness. We start out with a very ordinary practice and become something extraordinary. So I'm going to teach these four stages over the next several nights. For this evening, I'm just going to talk more about the first stage of loving kindness for oneself. Now, it's an interesting thing in the time of the Buddha, it seemed to be often taken for granted or quite widely understood that actually we all have love for ourselves before we have that for others. There's a wonderful dialogue in the Samyutta Nikaya between Queen Mallika and King Pasenadi. So if you're familiar with these, this is one of the most lovely couples in the Buddhist literature, because King Pasenadi was always a little bit kind of well-intentioned but a bit slow. Queen Mallika was like a slave girl, a flower seller, who was raised up to be the queen, and she was always kind of one step in front of her husband. So there's some very witty dialogues between the two of them. One of these dialogues, King Pasenadi asks his Queen Malika, who is it that you love the most in all the world? That's a somewhat pointed question, isn't it? The husband's going to ask the wife, and especially if the husband's a king, right? And the queen, the wife, is like a slave girl who's been sort of raised herself and made the chief queen. You'd think she'd be a bit kind of cautious about how she expressed herself, wouldn't you? Yeah. It's a very loaded question, but Malika was always very honest, and she said, I love myself more than anybody else in the world. And Parsenity was beside himself. How can you say you love yourself more than anybody else? You know, more than your children. Of course, what he meant to say was more than me. Yeah. And Malika said, well, actually, this is something that even the Buddha has taught, that each person actually loves themselves more than they love anyone else. And so Parsenity at that time wasn't yet converted to follow the Buddha, so he sort of grumbled underneath his breath, oh, my Buddha, every time the Buddha says something, you just say, yeah, you just go and agree with him. Anyway, eventually he became a very strong follower of the Dhamma. So, if we think about it, then it makes sense, doesn't it? Because actually, you know, the vast majority of our thoughts, our emotions, our concerns, our attachments, our ideas, all revolve around ourselves, as much as we would like to imagine, yeah, that we love somebody else, or we love our children, or our parents, or... But the reality is that, you know, when we get up in the morning, it's our teeth that we brush. Yeah? It's our stomach that we want to fill. So, in the chant of loving kindness, the chant of the Brahma Viharas, it includes the phrase sabbatataya, to each as to oneself. So starting from oneself, one spreads loving kindness to all beings. Of course, a lot of people find this quite difficult. It's a bit of a challenge. A lot of people are like, oh, well, I'm happy to do loving kindness for, you know, like anybody else, but please don't make me do it for myself. And of course, the very fact that we have that response is an indication of how much we really need to, yeah, how much we really need to accept ourselves. And we know the Buddha said we should have metta for all sentient beings, and you are all sentient beings. Yeah, you are all part of that, and each of us is worth just as much as anyone else. No more, but just as much. We're all worthy of loving kindness. I heard a story once of a lady who was staying at one of the monasteries in England. And for some reason, she became very disgruntled. She left and she joined a fundamentalist Christian sect. And she later wrote back to the monastery asking that they could please exclude her from their chanting of loving kindness every evening. They could spread loving kindness to all sentient beings except for her. They had to write back to her and say, sorry, it doesn't work like that. Yeah. People have these funny ideas about it. When I was at Wat Manachat in Thailand, we got a letter from a person asking for an expert in loving kindness meditation. They wanted to sponsor them to have a flight on the space shuttle so that they could fly up into space and spread loving kindness to all the aliens. Yeah, I must admit, it was kind of tempting. Yeah, wouldn't mind a flight on the space shuttle, but unfortunately we had to write back to them and say, oh, look, it works just as well from the surface of the Earth. There's no need to go into orbit. So we have to try to learn to accept ourselves. Learn to have loving kindness for ourselves. And that may be a bit of a process. It may not. Some people may find that comes easily. Other people may find that it comes a bit more difficult. So don't worry about that too much. For now, and as we're just getting started, just give it a go. Okay? So from now until tomorrow evening, and I'll teach this loving kindness for oneself, and we'll just try it out a few times, see what happens. And then tomorrow evening I'll talk a little bit more about it and a bit more about what to do if that's difficult or if you're struggling or having difficulties. And there's quite a few different things that we can do, so don't worry about that, but we'll just give it a go first. So the basic method here, whenever we come to sit with metta meditation, follow a number of stages. First stage is just mindful awareness. Okay? So that's what we've been practicing so far today. And for this stage of meditation, you can use whatever basic mindfulness practice that you're used to doing, whether it's Mahasi technique or Goenka technique or just Ajahn Brahm's silent awareness of the present moment or whatever. Doesn't really matter. So we just do that for 5 minutes or 10 minutes at the start of each meditation. The idea of that practice there is to get that sense of awareness, of comprehension, to know it, to collect yourself, to know here I am, I'm sitting here, to cut through to some degree the stream of thoughts, yeah, make the mind quiet, and also, especially, to recognize if you're carrying any feelings of anger, ill will, jealousy, annoyance, impatience, all of those things, and just to get an awareness of them. So this is the purpose of that stage. It's very similar, if those of you are familiar with Ajahn Brahm's technique of breath meditation, it's very similar to what he calls the silent awareness of the present moment at the start of the breath meditation. The only real difference is just to have a bit more focus on recognizing any of those feelings of ill will and so on, if there are any, yeah, just to acknowledge them. So we do that maybe 5 to 10 minutes at the start of each meditation. That's normally. Actually, during a retreat, for example, if you're doing, say, a lot of walking meditation or something, then if you can just come straight from walking meditation and go straight into the metta or whatever, if you feel the mindfulness is already flowing. But normally, we spend a few minutes to just establish the mindfulness first. When that's done, then we begin the metta itself, the loving kindness itself. To start with, we just say the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. And first thing we pay attention to is the quality of those words. We say them carefully, we say them evenly, we articulate them to ourselves clearly. Okay? And my teacher, Ajahn Chachai, said to say them, his words, like Shakespeare. So I don't quite know what a Thai meditation monk thinks Shakespeare sounds like. Actually, I kind of wondered about that at the time. But I think what he meant was say them very, very clearly, so you enunciate them clearly like you're speaking on the stage. See, sometimes what happens when we meditate is we tend to get a bit lazy. Yeah, we tend to sort of drift along in the meditation. Yeah, we just got a bit vague. So if we start there, when may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy, quite deliberately, quite firmly. So at this stage of the meditation, we're laying the foundations. Okay, so we want to have a solid foundation for the meditation. Okay, at this stage, don't worry about the feeling, don't worry about anything else. Just articulate the words clearly to oneself. Okay? And allow that to continue. Continue, continue, continue. Until you feel that's solid. Okay? Until you feel there's a sense of presence, a sense of reliability to it. When you feel that sense of reliability, then next thing to do is to reflect on the meaning of those words. Okay, so we just start with the sound of them. When the sound is there, then we reflect on the meaning of them. And you remind yourself, and this is very important, we all have a very, the most basic wish, the most fundamental wish we all have is that wish to be happy. It's what we're searching for our whole lives, isn't it? The wish to be happy. We don't know what it is. We seek for it in all the wrong places. As soon as we feel like we've got it, we lose it again. I always love the words in the American Constitution that we all have the fundamental right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Have you ever noticed that? We don't have the right to happiness itself. Yeah? It's very precisely worded. We have the right to run around for our whole lives chasing happiness and never actually finding it. Yeah, we all have that inalienable right. And most of us exercise that right, don't we? Yeah? That's exactly what we do with our life and our liberty. We chase happiness and never find it. Yeah? Of course, somebody who is happy, by definition, is not pursuing happiness. Yeah? So, just to reflect on that, to reflect that actually inside each of us is that powerful, fundamental wish to be happy. We don't have to analyze that. Okay, this is not a philosophy class. It's not a class on what is happiness, what is love, what is the goals of my life. If you want to do that, you can do that outside of the meditation. You can reflect about it or discuss it. That's the time for that. In the meditation, trust that you know, deep down inside you know what happiness is. You might not be able to articulate it. You might not be able to explain it. But you know what that is. Yeah? So I'm not going to try to explain it. I'm not going to try and say what happiness is. I'm not even going to say really what loving kindness is. You know what those things are. And they will come, the awareness, the understanding, the knowledge of that will come to you in your meditation. So this is that stage. So first of all, mindful awareness. Secondly, to bring up the words of loving kindness and make them clear and well established. Third one, to reflect on the meaning, remind yourself of that wish for loving kindness. And then the next stage is to be aware and to notice the feeling of loving kindness. So that feeling of loving kindness will arise from time to time. You'll notice it and it'll come up inside your body. And this is a very, very important point. This whole meditation, right from the beginning, we focused inside our body. Okay, when we first come to sit down, we focus on the feelings inside the body. And we keep on bringing our minds back, not letting the mind wander around here and there. Keep on bringing it back again and again and again and again and again and again and again. This body here. And when the feeling of loving kindness arises, we feel it as an emotion which is embodied. It's not a disembodied, it's not an abstract state. And this is, I think, one of the problems with loving kindness as it's often taught, is that it's often sounds very kind of abstract. It's an idea or a concept which sort of floats nicely up like a cloud somewhere, like a kind of pink cloud with spangles on it or something. But it doesn't have any, it's not grounded. And so it's that groundedness of it which gives it the strength, and which is where the strong concentration comes from. So when the feeling comes up, you feel it inside your body. Wherever it comes, doesn't matter. Often it'll arise in the heart, Yeah, so you can focus on your heart and see maybe it'll arise there, but often it'll arise somewhere else. It doesn't really matter. And keep on practicing until you can notice that, until somehow that feeling comes. And of course, that point where the feeling actually sparks, that's something which is not part of any technique. There's no method for that. I'll offer a few tips and hints and possibilities in the next few days, but basically that's something that you're going to have to find inside yourself. Yeah? Where does that feeling come from? When the feeling first arises, it can have it will have different kinds of qualities. Sometimes it will be quite strong. It will have a strong sense of rapture or uplift. It might just surge through the body, or just stay for a very short amount of time. It might be highly localized, or it might be quite diffuse. It'll have different kinds of qualities. Don't worry about that. What we're looking for is a sense of joy, a sense of happiness, a sense of pleasure, a sense of pleasure that's coming inside your body. So wherever you feel that, just watch that and focus on that feeling. This is the critical thing. When the feeling arises, we focus on it. And that's where all of that work we've done beforehand will come to our benefit. Okay? Normally, when the feeling of loving kindness comes, like any other feeling, it will tend to come, stay for a while, and then drift away. Yeah? So what we're trying to do here is to develop it. And to develop it, that's where all of that work, practicing the mindful awareness, establishing the words of loving kindness, establishing the meaning of the words of loving kindness, all of that is laying the basis. It's giving us strength and a focus to the mind, so that when the feeling comes and we pay attention to it, it will stay. It won't just drift away. It won't just come and go like the clouds. But we can focus on it, hold the mind there, hold the feeling. And as we learn to hold it longer, there comes in this kind of feedback process. And the longer we pay attention to it, the brighter the mind becomes. The brighter the mind becomes, the stronger the feeling becomes. And we can hold it longer and longer and longer. When we first start practicing, normally it will just come for a short time. Maybe it'll just be a flash, or come for a few seconds, maybe a few minutes. As we develop, and as our ability increases and the concentration increases, we can hold the feeling of metta for long periods of time, hours at a time. And hopefully we'll be able to experience that during this retreat. So the feeling of metta is always pleasant. It always has a sense of joy to it. So when that feeling is there, you won't be feeling restless. You won't be feeling agitated. It will bring with it a sense of tranquility, a sense of ease. So we can just hold that. Now, at this stage in the meditation, don't try to do anything else, okay? So we just do this much so far. We practice mindful awareness, the words of metta, the meaning of the words, and then look for the feeling, and then just hold the feeling in the mind and see how that goes. See how long that feeling will last. See what it's like to experience that. And it's very, very special, yeah, when you can actually feel that, because you realize that actually that very beautiful quality that the Buddha spoke about and that the great sages spoke about, that very beautiful quality of love, actually is inside you. It's not just an idea. It's not just a concept. It's an actual reality which we directly experience inside here. And I remember when I first was doing metta meditation, I was so overwhelmed by this. I was so struck. Because when you see that, you see the purity of it and the beauty of that feeling and that emotion, you realize, even just at the beginning, even just as you're starting, you get a glimpse of what the potential is, of what the power of this feeling can be. So we don't be in a rush. Don't be, you know, trying to do anything with it. Don't be getting all excited about it. Don't be thinking, you know, what next or anything like that. Just if we can have enough to hold that feeling, keep that, sustain that, then that will be very good for a starting point. Okay, so I've been talking for long enough, so let's do about 15 or 20 minutes of guided meditation, and then after that we can have some questions. Sitting quietly. Not worrying about the past. Not running off to the future. Just paying attention to the feelings, the sensations inside the body here and now. Pressure of the seat, the touch of cloth on the skin, any tensions or energies inside the body. Just notice these, be aware of them. Let them go. When the mind starts to think about this and that, just cut through the stream of thought, thinking, thinking, thinking. Don't be interested in the thought. Don't give it importance. Just cut through, thinking, thinking, thinking. And letting the mind be silent. watching in that gap between the thoughts. Noticing the mood, the emotion that we're carrying into this meditation, feeling it in the belly or the chest or in the face. Joy or sadness, jealousy, contentment, resentment or relief, whatever it is, just notice it. Oh, okay, that's how it is. Let go. Don't worry about it. Just watch what it feels like. When the mind feels reasonably centered, reasonably neutral, keep attention focused in the heart and say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Repeating those words again and again and again. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Saying the words clearly, evenly, distinctly, making a firm foundation for the mind. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. as the words become strong and clear, remind ourselves of the meaning of those words. That wish deep in the heart for true happiness. All of us share that wish. Remind ourselves don't worry about what happiness is. You know, trust yourself. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. As we continue with the words of metta, look inside and see if you can see the feeling of metta. It's a soft, gentle feeling of loving kindness, a warm feeling of joy and happiness that arises in the heart. When you notice that feeling, just hold that in the mind, keeping the feeling close. Like you are holding a little bird in your hands. If you hold the bird too tight, you'll squeeze it. If you hold it too loose, it'll fly away. keep the mind with that feeling, gently, firmly, steadily. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Now coming near the end of the meditation, and let the words of metta go. Let the feeling of metta fade away, and allow the mind to return to a neutral, empty space. And with the mind empty and clear, take a minute to reflect and review how that meditation went. What just happened? Did I understand the meditation method? What were the different stages of that like? How did my mind respond? Was there any feeling of metta there? And how does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Then you can open your eyes and come out of meditation. So I have a few written questions here, but I'll just give the chance if anyone has any oral questions, especially anything that come out of the talk or the practice this evening, then maybe I'll do them first. Well, if it's hilarious, then laugh at it. At this stage in the retreat, I would say just don't worry about it, okay? Just ignore it. If you're feeling, especially with metta meditation, if your mind feels like it is resistant, don't push it, okay? Just stop, do something else, okay? Go for a walk, do some breath meditation, whatever. And then come back and do the metta meditation when your mind feels quite good, when it feels okay, yeah? The last thing we want to do is develop like an association or a pattern in your mind where you sort of subconsciously equate metta meditation equals struggle, right? That's going to destroy everything, yeah? So do it when it's easy, yeah? And so that's good advice for everyone actually during the retreat is don't try to do metta meditation every time you sit. Only do it when you feel good and you feel that, yeah, you really want to try and give it a go. If you're feeling a bit sleepy or a bit restless or whatever, then do something else. Do some walking, do some breath meditation. Wait until your mind feels good and then do the metta then. Okay? If you still have that feeling of, you know, resistance and so on after a couple of days, then maybe we can talk about it in an interview. But for now, because we're just starting, don't worry about it. Yep. Sending metta to a log. Oh, well, try it both ways and see what works. What can I say? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a very good piece of advice in the Visuddhimagga, the classical Theravada meditation manual. And I think it's a piece of advice which is even much more relevant today. And it says that if you want to learn how to meditate, you can go and see a scholar or you can see a practitioner. If you see a scholar, they'll tell you what's in the books. If you see a practitioner, they'll tell you how they practiced. That's a fantastic piece of advice. And it really gets over all of these kinds of problems. Yeah, if you want to know what's in the books, that's what it says in the books. And as far as, you know, teaching from a practical basis, you know, we just share what we find works. Yeah. So if different people find different things that work, terrific. Yeah, it's not a problem. Yeah. Yes. You know, I did one retreat with metta and somebody said, oh, they didn't like the word may. Somebody else said, oh, I don't really like the word I. And somebody said, yeah, I have problems with happy. I said, what about B? Is B all right? Don't worry about the words. You know, again, it's just, these are just the details. If you want to use, you know, may my roosters be happy or whatever, then that's fine as well. Yeah, or roosters are cool or whatever, I don't really care. But again, this just the fact that we worry about it is already saying that we're giving too much importance to it. Actually, it's just a bunch of words. Just say it. It's all right. Another thing is just a bunch of other words. The words aren't the thing. Yeah. So remember that parable of the building the seat beside the water. Does it matter if the seat has, you know, two planks to sit on or three planks to sit on? Does it matter if the grass roof on top of the seat is a metre wide or a metre and a half wide? These things don't matter. Yeah. What matters is that we have a nice place to sit and we can watch the nice cool water. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the slight difference between happiness and metta. Yeah, there is, but don't worry about it. Technically the thing is that happiness is much broader, right? So for example, if you look at the four Brahma Viharas, for example, you know, you have loving kindness, compassion, mudita, sympathy, you know, altruistic joy, and equanimity. So all of those first three have a kind of happiness. So happiness, but it's slightly different flavour for each time. So metta is like one of the flavours of happiness. Metta as such is that quality of wishing for happiness. So it comes from a wish. If you think of the English word emotion, yeah, emotion, like it has a movement to it. Yeah, so the metta itself has this kind of emotion, has this kind of movement to it, rather than, you know, drinking a cup of coffee or something is happiness. Yeah, so there's a pleasure to it. So metta is a kind of that pleasure. Yeah. But this is one of the not a kind of paradox, but the trick of it is that having that wish for happiness actually makes you happy. And that's the basic psychology of love and kindness, is when you have that wish for happiness, it makes you happy. Yeah, so if the feeling comes up more quickly, don't resist it or push it away or anything, but just make sure that you still get grounded on the words of it, because sometimes what can happen is you can actually have a very strong emotional response, yeah, and when you start it and then it can be overwhelming, yeah, and it feels very beautiful, and it is very beautiful, but if you're not grounded on the beginning stages, it'll tend to sort of wash away. So it'll be like a surge of emotion, which then will sort of just come and go. So let the surge come, don't push it away, but just keep that focus until you're clear on the words of metta. Yeah. And hopefully the idea that will transform the kind of surge of emotion and make it more stable and make it last. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I'm wondering if that's helpful or unhelpful. I don't know. Sure, yeah. Yeah, it's quite a common thing, especially if you're used to doing breath meditation. It's neither particularly helpful or unhelpful, but the main thing is to just remember that if we're doing the metta meditation, that the feeling is the main thing we want to focus on. So if the only problem comes if we lose sight of that, and we can kind of fall back into doing breath meditation when in fact you want him to be doing metta, yeah. So that's the only problem. So this is something that's true in meditation generally, that that, of course, all these different meditations and different approaches are good, but you should have a clear idea what you're doing. This is the quality they call sampajanya, yeah? Clear comprehension. You know, at this time, I'm doing the metta meditation. This time, I'm doing vipassana. This time, I'm doing breath meditation, whatever it is. So you have a clear awareness what you're doing and don't kind of drift around too much from one to the other. Yeah. And this is also another reason why it's actually useful to do more than one meditation. Because it's when we start to do another one that you can realize actually it becomes like a habit. Yeah, your mind sort of goes back to breath meditation because that's just the habit, it just does that. And whenever you do anything by habit, then you don't have that clarity of mindfulness there. Yeah, so it can actually help for the breath meditation as well. Actually, I mean, just generally speaking, metta meditation, I've found personally, the single thing that's most helpful for doing breath meditation is doing metta meditation. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Just mainly just in those sitting meditations when you feel good and you want to do it. That's the main time. Don't be taking the meditation out and splurging it promiscuously over the universe, okay? Don't be like Mr. or Mrs. Metta and go around and beaming it at everything. This is where it gets conceited. And this is where you kind of lose touch with what it actually is. So this is why at the end of each meditation, we watch it finish. Yeah? You watch that feeling, that pleasant feeling, go away. And that's impermanence. Yeah? And that's the beginnings of developing insight. So I might talk more about that later in the retreat, but that's where you watch that. Yeah, and that's again, that's what I talked about earlier about those ideas of boundaries. Yeah, so you have that feeling, you develop it, and then it comes to an end. Yeah, that's outside of the meditation. Yes, if you want to do metta while you're walking, then you can, but best to just do it for a defined period while you're walking. Finish it, then you come and do your sitting, and then for a period like that, rather than just trying to do it all the time. Yeah. Sorry, we had a question at the back there beforehand. I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I was thinking, is it possible to sort of use the word, is it possible to use an experience of meditation as a guide to practice, or even a piece of music that you have such a strong emotional kind response to? Is it possible to do that
as a practice of the word? Yeah, I'll talk more about that tomorrow evening, but generally speaking, for now, just stick with the words. Okay? And I'll talk more about those things tomorrow evening. Yeah. But, yes?
If it's going to end, wouldn't it end naturally? How can everyone skill and end at the same time?
What do you mean, how can everyone's feelings end at the same time? Well, you watch a movie, everyone laughs at the same time and cries at the same time? Oh, if it doesn't want to end, then keep going. But see, the thing is, it's just a condition. Okay? So what we're learning to do is to work skillfully with those conditions. It's not actually that the feeling doesn't want to end, but it's what's actually happening is that you're getting attached to it. You're starting to get identified with it. And that we're wanting to have that, wanting to keep that feeling going forever. So that's why it's a very essential discipline to watch that feeling fade away at the end. Yeah.
When you say about watching a movie, it's like when you're experiencing meditation, everyone experiences something different, don't they?
Yeah, that's true. And but the point of the meditation is to move in a way, to move in a similar direction, even though we're starting out in very different places. But the actual meditation itself will be a similar experience. Some aspects of it will be similar. Some, of course, are different. But some aspects are similar. And this is one of them. It's just that idea to let the feeling go. Yeah? Don't worry about it. Yeah? Now, if having said which, right, if you're meditating and you're meditating comfortably along and the feeling of metta is there and it's flowing and you want to keep practicing, terrific, keep going as long as you like. Yeah, that's not a problem at all. And then you'll learn through experience, you'll learn when the mind has had enough. Yeah? And when the mind has had enough, you'll notice, oh, okay, the energy's maybe going down a little bit or the mindfulness is slacking off a little bit. And one of the fascinating things about that is that when your mind has been full of the metta, and it's such a beautiful, blissful feeling, and then you let that go and you have this equanimous feeling, and then you realize actually the equanimity is actually even better than the pleasant feeling. Yeah? Because the metta always has a slight sweetness to it. Yeah? And the neutral taste of equanimity actually feels almost a bit better than the metta. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, that's a hand, yes. To what, sorry? Yeah, don't worry about it.
Not sure, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. It's developed in a context, and the context gives it a meaning. Yeah. So that when we're practicing, we're making that choice. When we sit down to do metta, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to develop metta meditation. I'm going to develop these feelings. And I'm going to take that as far as it goes, and at the end I'm going to set it down, because this is just another conditioned thing. I'm going to set it down. It's not me, it's not mine. It lasts for a while and then it ends. That's all. It's like the glow around the candle flame. But everyone will experience it differently, yeah? And especially, it starts out very different for everyone. Meditation is very different for everyone. And it moves in a way that comes together. People's experiences are more similar the deeper you go. But at the beginning, it's very varied. But that's typically, it's a very simple and sort of a good sign, yeah? Is if it feels like that. If you feel, oh, this is like this little glow there, like a little patch of moonlight. Okay, I'm just wondering if there's time. It's getting a little bit late. It's now 9:30, so I might leave the written questions for the morning, if that's okay. And we can finish up here by paying respects.